Welcome to episode 23 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast. My name is Marcus Freestone, and this week's episode is part two of Jordan Peterson's Bible Lectures, How They Have Changed My Thinking. One of the things I find so remarkable about this series of talks is that Peterson, someone who describes himself as deeply religious, is continually approaching the Bible as a collection of instructive, illuminative folk stories rather than a dogmatic set of instructions that must be adhered to on pain of death or damnation. The latter approach is what has always put me off religion and has always seemed to me to be nonsensical and erroneous. How anybody can interpret something so complex from thousands of years ago as a series of direct, unopposable rules for every aspect of modern thought and behaviour is completely beyond me. I covered in the previous episode why the criticism of the Bible as being unscientific is totally wrong and egregiously missing the point. However, one thing that science possesses, which religion seems to totally lack, is the questioning of certainties. Another reason why I'm so intolerant of people's interpretation of the Bible, or indeed any other religious text, is the level of inflexibility. As modern life changes so quickly and drastically, surely it is sensible to modify your ideas of how to live your life. But religion almost never does this. It sticks to the same old ideas in the face of their increasing unsuitability. Imagine if the UK legal system hadn't changed and adapted to new circumstances during the last 1,000 years since its original inception. We'd be living in a nightmare of public flogging, stoning and hanging for the most trivial of crimes or perceived moral laxity. It would be an absolute disgrace. In Lecture 6, Peterson begins by emphasising that the Bible was written very recently in biological terms, 2,000 to 4,000 years ago. This made me realise that the way I was introduced to the Bible in school made it seem as if it was an impossibly long time ago, akin to the 65 million years since the dinosaurs became extinct. However, 2,000 to 4,000 years is a blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. As an atheist, I always saw the people portrayed in these Bible stories as cavemen, almost a different species to modern humans. But in watching these lectures, it's made me realise something that, given everything I've said in previous episodes, should have been blindingly obvious to me all along. The people who wrote the biblical stories were not different to us. They were modern humans in all important aspects, biologically, cognitively, intellectually. The only difference between then and now is the societies they lived in and the technological progress that has been achieved in the intervening centuries. The people who wrote the Bible had built pyramids. They had transported giant stones hundreds of miles and built Stonehenge using methods that we are still unable to replicate today, even with all our modern technology. They had advanced mathematics. They had architecture and incredible building skills. They made complicated tools. They had advanced civilized societies. They had agriculture. They had astronomy. These people were in no way primitive, and they were certainly not stupid. Indeed, it could be argued that in some respects they were cleverer than us and had practical skills that we have since let slip into oblivion. Therefore, it is surely the case that these stories were written and collated for a very good reason, and that they are consequently important in some way, rather than the load of delusional nonsense I have always considered them to be. I'm not saying for a second that I have had any kind of religious conversion, and I am still convinced that the anthropomorphic notion of God as a man with a beard in a cloud is ridiculous and egregious, but I am saying that I am now minded to view these stories as having important allegorical knowledge and wisdom that can be psychologically and philosophically useful to us today, if only we put our 21st century prejudices aside, ignore the institutional dogmatic interpretation of the stories, and extract the original ideas in the spirit in which they were written. So I think that it would be perfectly possible for a secular empiricist like myself to get something of permanent value from this collection of allegorical stories. However, I don't yet know if I could ever successfully eradicate all my negative experiences of religious education and the countless hypocritical and egregious pronouncements of various religious institutions, not to mention Scientology and all the other cults and pseudo-religions and all the collective havoc they have wrought in the world. There are so many religious ideas and consequences of the actions of the various churches over the last two centuries that make me very angry, and I am currently unable to separate them in my mind from the original biblical stories. The exacerbation of AIDS in Africa caused by the Catholic Church's paranoia about contraception, the persecution of gay people, the warmongering of Israel, the murder of abortion doctors in America, the institutional paedophilia in the Catholic Church, etc., etc., etc. This is also entrenched in my mind, and I've always considered these evils to be directly caused by the Bible. I now realise, however, that this is not strictly true. These wrongs are caused by people's interpretations of religious stories of all hues. No book, no story can ever turn somebody into a paedophile or a bigot. Those tendencies were always there, and religion is merely the justification they choose for this, or the framework within which these things happened. I always thought that the world would be a much better place without religion, but I now realise that this is not true. Nietzsche's predictions in the 19th century were worryingly accurate. The death of God, as he pronounced in Thus Spake Zarathustra, led to the genocidal ideology of Stalin and Hitler. So, if it were somehow possible to eradicate all religious thought, belief and institutions overnight, what would actually happen? Would there be a massive global rational enlightenment? Would there be an end to all violence and war? Would there be a rise of empiricism and a total cessation of gullibility? No, none of these utopias would result. What would really happen would be an instantaneous, sustained, huge, and long-term rise in the proliferation of pseudo-religions and cults like Scientology, in ever-increasing absurd and impossible conspiracy theories, and the current world religions would merely be replaced with new and equally divisive tribal and ideological factions. So, hardline atheist as I am, I do not think that ridding the world of religion would lead to any concrete improvements in any of our lives or in our societies in any tangible respect. Rather, I suspect it would almost certainly make things worse. Perhaps in an alternative reality, people would have read the original religious texts and taken them all as allegorical fiction rather than divine truth, an organized dogmatic religion would never have arisen. I do not know enough about the history of the various churches and religious institutions to comment on their precise origins and the factors that led to them taking this dogmatic, divisive, immovable path. I also don't know anything about the interplay between the various religions and how they intermingled and split apart over the centuries. In any case, speculating on alternative realities is as futile and counterproductive as trying to rewrite your own personal history. So I mentioned Nietzsche there and his proclamation of the death of God. And we talked about this last week as well. So, and one of the initial things that I mentioned last week that attracted me to Peterson were his existential lectures, where he talked extensively about Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and Sartre, all of whom I'm big fans of. So I'm going to read you a passage from Nietzsche about this, but first of all, I think I need to talk a bit more about Nietzsche, because he is much misunderstood. I think, as I said last week, he wasn't a Nazi. That was down to his sister. Nietzsche died in 1900, so obviously he had nothing to do with Hitler or the National Socialist Party, but his sister outlived him by many years, and she was a horrible person who was a big supporter of the Nazis and Hitler. And during the last few years of Nietzsche's life, at the end of the 19th century, he was basically immobile and dribbling in a chair due to having a complete mental breakdown and suffering several serious medical conditions. And she would charge people to come to their house and just sort of look and point at her famous brother, the thinker, while he just sat there staring into space, not knowing what was going on. So she was clearly an unpleasant person. And after Nietzsche died, she edited and twisted and mangled his work so that it seemed to support Hitler and the Nazis and their ideology. And one of the main ways that this happened, and a lot of the confusion with Nietzsche, is over the use of the word Superman. And this occurs in this passage I'm going to read now. So I just need to explain that for a second. Nietzsche used the word, the German word Übermensch, which he meant to mean overman rather than Superman. It's nothing to do with politics or other people. It's simply willpower over one's emotions and thought and behaviour. So the Übermensch, the overman, which is often mistranslated as Superman, Nietzsche's original idea of the Übermensch was, if you like, the next stage of human evolution, one where we were basically better people, where we had more control over ourselves. And in this passage that I'm going to read, Superman is mentioned several times, and what Nietzsche is saying is that following the death of God, which Nietzsche believed had already happened in the wake of Darwin's Origin of Species and other scientific and enlightenment progress and ideas, and the general shift in society in the mid to late 19th century, Nietzsche believed that we needed to be this Übermensch, this overman with this new superior willpower over oneself. We needed to be these new better people in order to cope with the gap that was left by the death of God. And that if Nietzsche believed that if we didn't improve ourselves, that society would deteriorate without the overarching glue of religious ideology, and that these would be replaced with much worse ideologies. And of course, they were, because religion in the 20th century in the West was replaced with the ideology of Hitler and Stalin and Chairman Mao and Pol Pot and many others. So, here is a passage from Thus Spake Zarathustra, which is written in a sort of, to me, it's written in a kind of parody of the Bible. And I say Nietzsche started out as a Christian and then kind of, it's not clear whether he actually lost his faith in God, but he clearly lost his faith in the church. And there are many passages in here in his other book where he is extremely critical about the church and religious institutions. And indeed, it could be in, he could be interpreted as saying that it is those very institutions that have killed the idea of God and have led to all these problems. So, okay, here we go. This is from section 24 in the Happy Isles. Isles, as in islands, not Isles of a church. That would be that wouldn't, that's never occurred to me before. That wouldn't make sense, would it? Talking about the death of God and yet you're in the Happy Isles of a church. Okay, I told you Nietzsche was funny. Okay. The figs fall from the trees. They are good and sweet. And in falling, the red skins of them break. A north wind am I to ripe figs. Thus, like figs, do these doctrines fall for you, my friends. Imbibe now their juice and their sweet substance. It is autumn all around and clear sky and afternoon. Lo, what fullness is around us. And out of the midst of superabundance, it is delightful to look out upon distant seas. Once did people say God when they looked out upon distant seas. Now, however, I have taught you to say Superman. God is a conjecture, but I do not wish your conjecturing to reach beyond your creating will. Could ye create a God? Then I pray you, be silent about all gods, but ye could well create the Superman. Not perhaps ye yourselves, my brethren, but unto fathers and forefathers of the Superman could ye transform yourselves, and let that be your best creating. God is a conjecture, but I should like your conjecturing restricted to the conceivable. Could ye conceive a God? But let this mean will to truth unto you, that everything be transformed into the humanly conceivable, the humanly visible, the humanly sensible. Your own discernment shall ye follow out to the end. And what ye have called the world shall but be created by you. Your reason, your likeness, your will, your love shall itself become, and verily for your bliss, ye discerning ones. And how would ye endure life without that hope, ye discerning ones? Neither in the inconceivable could ye have been born, nor in the irrational. But that I may reveal my heart entirely unto you, my friends, if there were gods, how could I endure to be no God? Therefore there are no gods. Yea, I have drawn the conclusion, now, however, doth it draw me. God is a conjecture, but who could drink all the bitterness of this conjecture without dying? Shall his faith be taken from the creating one, and from the eagle his flight into eagle heights? God is a thought, it maketh all the straight crooked, and all that standeth real. What? Time would be gone, and all the perishable would be but a lie. To think this is giddiness and vertigo to human limbs, and even vomiting to the stomach. Verily, the reeling sickness do I call it, to conjecture such a thing. Evil do I call it, and misanthropic. All that teaching about the one, and the plenum, and the unmoved, and the sufficient, and the imperishable. All the imperishable, that's but a simile, and the poets lie too much. But of time and of becoming shall the best similes speak, a praise shall they be, and a justification of all perishableness. Creating, that is the great salvation from suffering, and life's alleviation. But for the creator to appear, suffering itself is needed, and much transformation. So there's quite a lot in there, and it's understandable why some people find Nietzsche kind of hard to read and impenetrable. But to me, there's just so much, you know, that's just over a page, there's so much sort of wisdom and poetry and literature and beauty and some humour as well in there. So what Nietzsche is saying there is that in the wake of the death of God, because science and rationality have proved to his mind that God is an untenable idea now in society, and that's proved right certainly in the Western world, in which he was obviously writing, being European. And what he's saying is that it is in order to avoid the sort of problems that he foresaw us having in the 20th century, and which have horribly transpired on a mass scale, that Nietzsche thought that what we had to do was to not rely on some mythical, supernatural, anthropomorphic creator. We needed to create our own willpower, to take responsibility for our own lives, to create our own meaning. We needed to create something that could replace the magic and wonder of religion. And I think most people have singularly failed to do that. Hence, you know, the sad state of the Western world, and indeed most of the world today in the 21st century. And it strikes a particular chord with me, because I began reading Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and Camus and Sartre and Kafka and Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Colin Wilson. I began reading all them in my early to mid 20s because I found being an atheist was just deeply dissatisfying in and of itself, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, atheism isn't a thing. It's not a philosophy or a belief. It's just the absence of belief. And so I looked to science and philosophy and psychology to provide some meaning to my life. And I think I've mentioned it before that whilst I love existential fiction, one criticism I would have of the majority of it is that it often only presents the problem. It illustrates the problem frighteningly well, but ultimately doesn't provide any solutions. And I think from what I've read about Sartre, he very much saw his work as one whole piece of work, one whole piece of writing, that maybe he thought that the fiction illustrated the problems and then the nonfiction provided the answer. But obviously, if you don't know that, that's, you know, that's a bit of a problem. And I found in my 20s, before I had really studied a lot of psychology and philosophy, and before I had really dealt with my own, you know, mental and psychological problems that I've detailed in previous episodes of the podcast and in the book, before I dealt with all that, I found existential fiction, I found it all very engaging and intriguing, and I couldn't put it down. But I also found it depressing and nihilistic, especially Camus' short novel, which in French is L'Étranger, though I think in America and most countries it's called The Stranger, but for some reason in Britain it's always been published as The Outsider. But anyway, Camus, The Outsider, or The Stranger, L'Étranger, about Meursault, who kills someone in self-defense and ends up in court and has his character assassinated. And the final, it's an amazing book. It's just so gripping. But the end of it is just so bleak and nihilistic. It genuinely depressed me. And I thought for years that, you know, my life had no meaning and purpose. But I've now realized that it does, in a non-anthropomorphic spiritual way, as I've detailed throughout previous episodes of the podcast and also in the book. So mentioning this is a kind of link as well, because I've had another listener question this week on the Facebook page, Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. You can contact me via that or via email, marcus.freestone@yahoo.com, or there's a link to both on marcusfreestone.com, the website, which contains this podcast and all my books and music and everything. And the listener question I've had this week is about the work of Camus, particularly the myth of Sisyphus. And I can't access the question at the moment, but it's basically about how do we draw a non-nihilistic conclusion from the philosophy of people like Camus, and in particular from the myth of Sisyphus. And I read that when I think I was about 24, and I found it very inspiring, but I think I kind of missed the point. But I now have a much more positive, non-nihilistic interpretation of existentialism and of everything. And I came to that even before I took these miraculous new tablets that I'm on, which I mentioned a few episodes ago. So it's not just down to that. It's down to all the work I've been doing that are over the last 25 years that I've detailed in the podcast and the books. So next week will be the final episode of 2017, because then it's Crimble, as I call Christmas. And so I'm going to have a week off for that. And I said last week, I'm going to do at least 3 episodes on the topic of negative thinking, because looking at the YouTube channel, that's by far the most popular subject on there. That episode I did, PDR Spensky and Negative Thinking, has had like 10 times more views than any other subject on there. So I'm going to do at least 3 episodes on that. And next week I'll be starting with the listener question about Camus, existentialism, the myth of Sisyphus, and how we can avoid nihilism and negative thinking in the wake of that. And then I'll go on in the next few episodes to talk about the psychology of positive and negative thinking, about different philosophers, and about what neuroscience has to say about the actual mechanics of it. So, as ever, if you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments, then marcusfreestone.com, or go to the Facebook page or email me, and all questions welcome. Please keep sending them in, because I'd like to keep doing this every week. And I'm also hoping to set up a Patreon page in the new year, although I don't really fully understand what that is, but I'm hoping to do that, and hopefully I can get a little bit of support and encouragement and buy some new equipment. And I would really, if I can get some substantial donations in, I'd really like to travel around and interview people for this podcast. I would love to go to universities and talk to psychologists and philosophers and neuroscientists, but I would need some funding to do that. But anyway, I know that the week before Christmas is not a good time to ask you to part with some cash, but in a new year, when you've recovered, if you consider chucking me a few dollars on PayPal, or hopefully the Patreon thing will be set up by then. And I believe on Patreon you can offer people rewards, so I shall work out something nice to send you for supporting me in that way. And I have several free ebooks and lots of free music out there. Check out marcusfreestone.com, and I'll see you next week with part one of Negative Thinking, Camus, and the Myth of Sisyphus. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and you may be thinking that I haven't actually talked much about Peterson's Bible lectures in this episode, but if you watch them, he only really spends about 5% of time talking about the Bible, and he spends most of the time talking about psychology and philosophy and about Nietzsche and Jung and things. So I've followed his example. So that's the end of the episode. Here's the closing music, and stay positive, and I'll see you next week. Bye-sy bye. Thank you.